This podcast is for personal consumption only and may not be proliferated or reproduced in any way without the explicit permission of its author.
Thanks so much, and thanks to Gaia for organising this. It's been good. I'd like to begin with a section of a letter written a year ago to a government-initiated review. In March 2009, two national peak non-government organisations, the National Ethnic Disability Alliance and the Aboriginal Disability Network, lodged a joint submission to the National Human Rights Consultation. Before I read a section of the letter, I need to note my own vested interest here, since I was a co-author of the submission. The submission was co-written by Mr. Damien Griffiths, the Executive Officer of the Aboriginal Disability Network, which is a national peak representing Aboriginal people with disability in Australia, and myself, the then Executive Officer of the National Ethnic Disability Alliance, national peak representing non-English speaking background people with disability. As such, today's paper is a part reflection on myself and my own engagement with anti-racist strategy, but it is also a vehicle to consider sovereignty and race, in particular, how the right to discriminate links to sovereignty, including the differentiated sovereignty rights that are attributed as part of a racialised hierarchisation that belongs to an analysis of the effects of settler colonialism. Following Wolfe, I treat settler colonialism as an ongoing process that encompasses the history of settler practices, including recent non-European permanent migration, which has continually restructured relations of power, including the structure of white sovereignty in Australia. The joint letter contains six short points, which I'll read in full, just to give you a context. Quote, number one, Indigenous people with disability and people from non-English speaking backgrounds with disability experience significant barriers to social and economic participation, including racial discrimination on the basis of cultural, linguistic and race difference. Two, through its members and constituents, the Aboriginal Disability Network, I'll call ADN, and NEDA, National Ethnic Disability Alliance, are aware of numerous instances where Indigenous people with disability and people from non-English speaking backgrounds with disability are unfairly denied access to health and disability services, educational opportunities, employment and housing. Often these people with disability express a concern that they have been discriminated against both because of their race and because of their disability. Number three, discrimination against Indigenous people with disability and people from non-English speaking backgrounds with disability often exacerbates existing forms of entrenched disadvantage and disempowerment. For example, discriminatory access to health and disability services contributes negatively to poor health outcomes experienced by all Indigenous people, particularly in rural and remote areas. Similarly, poor access to services or housing for some migrants and refugees with disability will further intensify the poverty experienced by these groups. Number four, ADN and NEDA believe that a strong commitment to anti-discrimination principles is fundamental to Australia's human rights framework and could assist to reduce the unfair barriers experienced by many people with disability, including Indigenous people with disability and people from non-English speaking backgrounds. Five, however, both ADN and NEDA share a concern that there's little recognition in existing legislation that the experience of discrimination can be complex and not simply reducible to disability or race discrimination, but must be treated as a combination of both. Given both the diversity of Australia's population and Australia's historical record in relation to inclusion, both good and bad, there appears to be a strong argument in favour of examining complex forms of discrimination to ensure maximal protections for all Australians. Freedom from discrimination is a right for all Australians, regardless of culture, race or language. ADN and NEDA strongly recommend that the Australian government examine intersecting forms of discrimination as part of the development and enhancement of Australia's human rights protection. ADN and NEDA also believe that such a commitment will go some way towards meeting the Australian government's social inclusion objectives. Now, the letter is, of course, a policy submission, so it uses the language of government. It's trying to talk about social inclusion and rights and whatever. But I think in some ways the letter was remarkable. The joint letter represented an attempt to find points of announced solidarity in relation to race and disability between racially excluded migrant and refugee groups and Aboriginal people in order to strategically navigate towards a shared social policy outcome. In this sense, there was something remarkable about the process involved in negotiating this agreement. Indeed, this might be treated as an example of a solidarity based upon the fact of a common dispossession, the kind of solidarity that I believe thinkers such as Alfonso Lingus, Jacques Derrida and Judith Butler have alluded to in their own way. However, this strategic solidarity claim must put aside a history and tensions inherent between recent migrants with disability and Indigenous people with disability. In particular, in light of a history of settler colonialism, where migrants might not be only victims but also agents of discrimination. Migrants and Indigenous people do not necessarily share the same topicality. If settler colonialism might be understood as a slow, combative process of progressive displacement of Indigenous sovereignty rights, then even potentially marginalised migrant groups, including those with disability, share in and benefit from this process, with material gains to be won, including in access to health, education and housing, to use the policy parlance. Solidarity in this sense, while strategic and useful in advancing a potentially shared objective, that is, in reducing discrimination, might risk itself becoming part of a process of settler colonialism rather than simply as an attempt at decolonisation. Simply put, while marginalised migrant groups might gain rights to non-discrimination as part of their alliances with Indigenous people, what guarantee is there that the settler colonialist right to discriminate against Indigenous people might remain unchallenged? While migrants might gain improved access to education and housing, will those benefits also flow to Indigenous allies? Will the outcome be a house for a recent non-white migrant at the expense of continuing Aboriginal homelessness? I take the view here that race must be understood as a continuously evolving and infinitely segmented form of social division that simultaneously undermines and constructs social solidarity. Race, in other words, is a continuing war that endlessly and tactically, it would seem, reconstructs the categories of enemy and friend. I'm informed here in particular by Michel Foucault's 1976 lectures, published in English under the title Society Must Be Defended. Foucault came to understand all power relations as involving war through other means, and thus came to look for how intense life and death divisions between people were mediated within the civil political space. Quote, and this is a famous quote, "We are therefore at war with one another. A battlefront runs through the whole of society continuously and permanently, and it is this battlefront that puts us all on one side or the other. There's no such thing as the neutral subject. We are all inevitably someone's adversary." Race and racism is, of course, closely tied to the account that Foucault offers in these lectures, since the stratifications within societies that Foucault associates with warlike domination generate the inside and outside relations of the nation and subdivide people into categorisations that assume to share a homogenous biological relation. Racism is thus a way, quote, "a way of separating out the groups that exist within a population, a way of establishing biological typecetera within a population that appears to be a biological domain. Racism works by putting people at war with each other. The obvious divisions, for example, between black and white, illustrate this and deliver real advantages." I see a usefulness in this approach, particularly in challenging our common sense assumptions about the way forward and the way we might interpret strategies such as alliances and solidarities around so-called common issues. This is also a way to consider how we might bridge discussions around biopolitics with those of critical race theory. Aileen Morton Robinson, for example, has noted the absence of theoretical analysis exploring the intersection of biopower and whiteness, pointing out the opportunity to critique the value of strategies used by activists and scholars to engage with sovereignty, race and whiteness, including the language of rights. Morton Robertson further poses a series of questions on how biopower might generate racialized norms. She asks, how does biopower work to produce whiteness as an invisible norm, and does it function as a tactic and strategy of race war? And the nature of this war is to attempt to erase the fact that there is indeed a source of conflict. For example, in Australia it has become convention to acknowledge that Indigenous people as traditional owners of the land during public events, at conferences and before speeches. An acknowledgement of prior sovereignty hides the truth of war within it, the fact that I stand on this land because war has occurred and continues to this day. This war, and the racialised economy it maintains, delivers benefits to a range of people, including myself. War is the unspoken element in this acknowledgement, a war that is a battle for sovereignty, a war that I'm inescapably invested in because I quite literally stand or sit on this land. Sovereignty is important here, not only because colonialism involves a process of sovereign displacement, but because I regard sovereignty as a living concept, something which both authorises and embodies. We carry sovereignty in our heart. This was the sovereignty the English brought with them to Australia from 1770 onwards. Thus, as the English 19th century jurist puts it, Lord Kingsdown states, and this is talking in relation to Terra Nullius, where Englishmen establish themselves in an uninhabited or barbarous country, they carry with them not only laws, but the sovereignty of their own state, and those who live amongst them and become members of their community become also partakers and subject to this law. And I guess Lorenzo put this in relation to settler sovereignty, the way that sovereignty is carried on. But the difference for me is trying to understand, how does this sovereignty relate to recent migrants? Can we say that settlers, well, recent migrants, have this sovereignty in a different form? Settler colonialism creates the prospect that the migrant, even the non-white migrant, carries some of this authorisation. Clearly a different authorisation from an Englishman, but an authorisation nonetheless. This is an authorisation to commit violence, either material or symbolic, which in line with the licence given of establishing themselves in an uninhabited or barbarous country, amounts to the beginning of a distinct economy of racialisation that would place in combative opposition white settlers, indigenous people and non-white migrants. This authorisation to carry sovereignty begins with the right to discriminate, which is linked within this racialised economy fundamentally, perhaps inextricably, to a promise of freedom and autonomy. Perhaps this is why the recognition claims of non-white migrants seem to be directly at the expense of others, including Indigenous people, because recognition within this framework necessarily implies a hierarchisation, a success of the settler colonialist project. Literally, why do you hear these racist comments from our migrant parents? You know, like literally. The first article of the French Declaration on the Rights of Man and Citizen is usually translated as such, quote, "Men are born free and equal in rights. Social distinctions may be founded only upon the general good." The first article, the two sentences. The second sentence is interesting because it potentially contains a corrective of the first sentence, which is contradictory of that first sentence. Namely, that equality is the steadfast rule, although there may be good reasons for inequality. The second sentence is further interesting because of the indeterminacy involved in translating the last part of the second sentence, namely how we might define the expression, l'utilité commune. While I cannot claim any expertise in French, let alone its pronunciation, I might need you, Kieran, it's clear that this expression can be and has been translated differently. Another translation of Article 1 of the French Declaration, rather than proposing that social distinction should only occur on the basis of some general good, is a translation that says social distinctions can only be founded on a common utility. Utility here does not refer to an immemorial moral or ethical concept, i.e. the good, but to a usefulness or helpfulness towards a particular goal. And this usefulness must be weighed against a set of criteria, whether quantitative or qualitative. The gap between the idea of the good and the utilitarian is, of course, a potentially large one, and has been and will be subject to pages and pages of philosophical debate. However, as I argue here, the chasm between the good and what has utility is easily bridged by a concept that is in itself no radical in breadth, namely sovereignty. A social division that undermines the prospect of social solidarity, whether good or utilitarian, is an expression for a right to discriminate, either fairly or unfairly, as a prerogative of sovereignty. Because although while we are told and accept that unfair discrimination is intolerable, even illegal, this still leaves open the question of what constitutes fair discrimination. Whether such a concept of fair discrimination is even possible, whether it is even good. And it is fair discrimination that is utilitarian in nature, forces us to ask, who benefits? There are a number of fair discriminations that we actively tolerate. An example of this discrimination is against the poor, which is, of course, the prerogative of capitalism. And it is both tolerated and accepted, indeed it is actively encouraged by law, seen as either good or offering some general utility. We might say the same for disability discrimination, which has and continues to incorporate a field of justifiable and non-justifiable, fair and unfair discriminations, some sanctioned by law, some tolerated by law, some utilitarian in nature, and through a process of normalisation, appear as good or natural. In what way, then, might we understand race as also involving a right to discriminate, which, leaving aside ineffective discrimination laws, which rarely, if ever, challenge this right to discriminate, actually operate as a kind of sovereign prerogative? This right to discriminate accords in its operation differential subject positions which enable a continuing process of displacement of Indigenous sovereignty and a reinforcement of a settler sovereignty. Indeed, we might ask in this context, is the right to discriminate central to sovereignty itself? I close here with a brief reading of Jacques Derrida's recently released final lectures under the title The Beast and the Sovereign, Part 1. Part 2 hopefully will come out December this year. This volume reproduces lectures delivered by Derrida in 2001-2002 and is constructed posthumously on the basis of previously unpublished notes and audio recordings. The title of the seminars, The Beast and the Sovereign, is closely connected to a series of wordplays which centre around the French word bête, a word which contains a rich association of meanings, including not only as a function as a noun for beast, creature, dog or insect, but also as an adjective for stupid or silly. Amidst these wordplays, we find an interesting and potentially useful conceptualisation of sovereignty that Derrida offers through the connection to animal figures, the fox, wolf, lion, etc., and through the persuasive linkages drawn that he draws between a grandiose, hyperbolic sovereignty and the symbolism of the phallus. I'll leave those arguments aside for the moment. However, what's interesting is the connection Derrida draws between sovereignty and bêtise, or what we might translate as stupidity. In particular, this seems to provide an opportunity for a clever and useful reconceptualisation of sovereignty and understanding of the right to discriminate. Examining the word bêtise, Derrida observes that bêtise is not simply error, but represents an unexplainable failure of judgment. Quote, I let myself go. I surprise myself by doing a bêtise. Here begins a long rumination on the idea of bêtise and the difficulty of its translation and definition to show that sovereignty implies stupidity in its operation. Reason and force follow each other since the prerogative to decide operates as a form of judgment in spite of knowledge, rather than on the basis of conceding a known truth. Derrida thus notes, bêtise always triumphs. It is always in the war we are talking about, on the side of the victor. Placing this within the Cartesian tradition, Derrida thus points to both the defining condition of sovereignty as a right to stupidity, and also the defining aspect of human sovereignty over the non-human as a stupidity that simultaneously declares its intellectual superiority over other beasts, and in the same movement declares itself as not beastly. While Derrida's focus here is on the figure of the animal, we might easily import the same logic to think through the humanisation of the white coloniser and the interconnected animalisation of the coloniser's other, including the possibility of a racialised hierarchisation, which allows for attributing subject positions and intelligence in line with an evolving sovereign prerogative. We will consider letting non-white migrants into this country, but only the ones who we think might have the skills and ability to continue this process of colonisation. Stupidity is an accurate way to describe the obstinacy of a white sovereign prerogative, a right to act in spite of truth, which in turn constructs superiority as truth, that is, as a right to judge poorly inherent in the right to judge. We need only gaze across the field of sovereign decision-making to verify the accuracy of this description. Everything from the declaration of war as a preemptive strike, the arbitrary creation of zones of judicial exemption, and the systematic denial and erasure of sovereignty claims by colonised people might aptly be described as examples of a willful stupidity, as a right to decide, even when the evidence suggests that there's no right to exercise this decision. But we might finally also note that the right to discriminate is an expression of this same stupidity. For how else might it be possible to suspend the belief that all men are created equal than through a stupidity that simultaneously announces a right to non-equality on the basis of a topicality, whether based on good or utility? The challenge for thinking through this in a settler colonial context is understanding that this right to discriminate is distributive in nature. It resides in the hearts of the king's subjects, it provides an incentive, and it offers its own social solidarity through a public sphere which is both purely white and able-bodied, even if this violates a principle of a universal equality. The second challenge for us, though, is to think how to squarely attack this right to discriminate, and with it make vulnerable the social solidarity that racial hierarchisation offers as its lure. Thank you.